Have you ever found yourself looking at a list of numbers? Maybe it's sales figures or student test scores, or even like race times, and you just instinctively pick out the smallest ones. Pretty straightforward when the list is short, right? But what if that list suddenly had, I don't know, a million entries or even more? How would a computer even begin to tackle that reliably and, fast? Today, we're taking a deep dive into a concept that's so fundamental to computing, it's practically bedrock. The fine minimum standard algorithm. This isn't just some theoretical idea. It's one of those foundational recipes, you could say, in the world of code that really underpins so much of our digital lives, often without us even realizing it.
That's exactly right. And when we talk about standard algorithms, we're basically referring to a proven collection of instructions, a reliable method a computer follows to solve a particular problem. And the really insightful part, I think, is that this standardization lets developers all over the world speak a common language, reuse incredibly reliable code, and, well, build these hugely complex systems without constantly reinventing the wheel. It's sort of the silent enabler of modern software development.
And in this deep dive, we're going to unpack exactly what fine minimum is, how it's implemented conceptually, and how it connects other really vital programming ideas. We'll explore how data is organized, the power of breaking down code into reusable pieces, and even how programmers make sure these algorithms work perfectly every single time. It's kind of a shortcut to understanding a core computational thinking pattern that powers everything from your sports apps to advanced scientific research. So let's jump in. When we say fine minimum, it sounds, well, deceptively simple, especially for a shortlist. But how does that simplicity translate to handling, say, millions of data points effectively? What's the core principle that makes it so scalable?
Well, what's fascinating here is its elegance and also its close relationship to fine maximum. The underlying logic for both is remarkably similar, just with a slight twist in the comparison. Remember, a computer's processor, at its most basic level, can really only focus on one thing at a time. So it needs a disciplined, systematic approach to work through vast amounts of data. For fine maximum, you typically start by assuming the very first item in your list is the largest you've seen so far. Then you methodically compare it to every other item, updating your, let's call it, largest variable if you discover something bigger. For fine minimum, the process is essentially flipped. You assume the first item is the smallest, then you compare it against all the rest, always updating your stored value if you happen to discover a smaller one. It's this iterative comparison that builds up the correct answer over time.
And that simple systematic comparison is what makes these algorithms so powerful. They're not just abstract ideas from textbooks, are
That's
they?
not all.
They are fundamental to countless computational tasks we rely on every day. It's pretty remarkable how such a straightforward process guarantees an accurate result, no matter the scale. So, how does this systematic approach actually play out step by step? Can you walk us through it?
Absolutely. Let's walk through the conceptual steps of the fine minimum algorithm so you can really visualize it in action. Imagine you have a list of numbers right there in front of you. The very first step is initialization. You start by taking a variable, let's just call it current minimum for now, and you assign it the value of the first element in your
Your
list.
very first one.
Yeah, the first one. This is crucial. It gives the algorithm a concrete starting point for comparison. Without it, the computer wouldn't really know what to compare subsequent values against.
Makes sense.
Then comes iteration, which basically just means looping. The algorithm then proceeds to systematically check through the rest of the array one by one. This is typically done with what's called a loop, like a fixed loop that repeats for each item in the list, making sure every single value gets inspected.
Got it. Checking every single one.
Exactly. And inside that loop, you have the comparison and update step. Each subsequent item in the array is compared to the value currently held in your current minimum variable. Now, if the algorithm finds an item that is smaller than your current minimum, then the current minimum variable is immediately updated with this new smaller value. It overwrites the old one.
So it always keeps the smallest one found so far.
Precisely. And finally, once the loop finishes, meaning every single item in the array has been checked, that variable holding the current minimum will contain the absolute smallest value from the entire array. That's your answer.
It's the consistent, diligent comparison that truly guarantees you'll find that elusive smallest number. And it makes you wonder, what kind of structure holds all this data for the algorithm to efficiently sift through? You mentioned arrays.
Excellent question, because this algorithm typically operates on what we call arrays. Think of a one-dimensional array as a neatly organized collection of related values, almost like a row of mailboxes, each holding a piece of data. They're stored in consecutive memory locations, which makes them incredibly efficient for rapidly accessing the data.
Okay.
Each item is referred to by its unique index or position within that sequence, usually starting at position zero, actually.
Ah, right, the zero-based indexing.
Yep. Arrays are designed to hold an ordered sequence of simple data types and, critically, all of the same type. So all integers or all real numbers or maybe all strings.
That makes perfect sense. So an array might hold a list of integers like, I don't know, ages of students or perhaps real numbers representing temperatures throughout a week. You could even use it for strings, you said, like if you're looking for the minimum alphabetically, maybe?
Exactly. Finding the word that comes first alphabetically.
And as you mentioned, that current minimum value is constantly changing. How does a computer handle that specific update?
That's where the concept of a variable comes in. Our current minimum is stored in one of these. A variable is simply a named storage location that holds a single piece of data at any given time. When new data goes into a variable, the existing data is automatically overwritten.
Just gone.
Yep. This is precisely how that current minimum value gets updated as the algorithm finds smaller and smaller numbers. It's always keeping track of the absolute smallest value encountered so far.
Okay, let's try and make this even more concrete. Imagine a real-world scenario, like a track meet. You've got a list of competitors and their finish times. We need to find the winner of the race. How would this apply?
This is a perfect application where fine minimum really shines. In such cases, you often use something called parallel arrays.
Parallel arrays.
Yeah, these are two or more arrays that work alongside each other, storing different but corresponding information. For example, one array could hold the names of all the runners, and another array right next to it conceptually could hold their times. Same order. So, in our race winner scenario, the find minimum algorithm is used to identify the fastest time, the smallest number in the times array.
Right, because fastest time means smallest number.
Exactly. Once the algorithm finds the minimum time in the times array, it also gives us the position or index of that minimum time. And because the arrays are parallel, lined up, we can use that exact same index to look into the names array and retrieve the corresponding name.
Ah, I see. So finding the winner is really just finding the minimum time and then using its position to pull the correct name.
You got it. It's a really powerful way to link related pieces of data and derive meaningful results.
It's fascinating how finding a simple number connects directly to a real-world outcome, like crowning a race winner.
Mm-hmm.
But all this elegant logic, these arrays and comparisons, how do we actually translate that into something a computer understands and executes? This must be where the art and, well, engineering of software design takes center stage.
Absolutely. And it often starts long before we even write a single line of actual code that the computer runs. Programmers often begin with something called pseudocode.
Pseudocode. Yep. Like fake code.
Sort of, yeah. Think of it as a rough blueprint, an artificial and informal language that helps programmers map out the logic of an algorithm, the what and how, before getting bogged down in the strict rules, the syntax, of an actual programming language like Python or Java.
Okay, so it's a planning tool.
Exactly. And to make complex programs manageable, and also to enable teams of programmers to work efficiently together, code is often broken down into smaller, self-contained units. We call these modules, or procedures, or functions. This approach massively improves readability, allows for incredible reuse of code. You write it once, use it many times, and makes finding and fixing errors, debugging, much simpler.
Right. So what's the difference between, say, a function and a procedure?
Good question. Generally, functions are specialized modules designed to calculate and then return a single piece of information, like, for example, the actual minimum value itself. Procedures, on the other hand, are typically for tasks that do something specific, like maybe displaying that winner's name to you, the user, or saving data to a file. They perform an action rather than just returning a value.
I see.
And these modules, they need to talk to each other. Right. They communicate using parameters, which are special variables used to pass information between functions or procedures. The actual data you send in is called an argument.
This modular approach sounds incredibly powerful. It leads to a really interesting challenge I saw. Mentioned, what if you wanted to write a single function that could find both the minimum and the maximum value? Could you do that?
Yes. And that really shows the power of modularity and using parameters.
How would that work?
Well, you could design the function to accept not only the list of numbers, but also another argument, another piece of information that tells it what to do. Maybe a string like findMan or findMax.
Like an instruction.
Exactly. An instruction passed in as a parameter. Inside the function, you'd have a little bit of logic, probably an if statement that checks that instruction. If it says find min, it uses the comparison logic for minimum. If it says find max, it uses the logic for maximum.
Wow, so most of the code, the looping, accessing the array, stays the same.
Precisely. You reuse almost all the same code structure. This approach saves a huge amount of development time, drastically reduces the chance of errors because you're not duplicating logic, and makes your software far more flexible and adaptable down the road. It's really efficient design.
Okay, now even with a beautifully designed and modular algorithm like find minimum, or even that combined min-max function, we need to be absolutely sure it works correctly every single time. And that brings us to the critical phase of testing and debugging. I've heard that saying in software development, something like, testing can only demonstrate the presence of errors. It cannot demonstrate their absence. What does that really mean in practice?
That saying is spot on. It highlights a fundamental truth. No amount of testing can prove code is perfect. It can only find the bugs that are there. So because you can't prove perfection, testing needs to be really systematic and comprehensive. You try to cover as many scenarios as possible.
How do you do that? What kind of data do you use?
Well, when testing, we use different types of data to really probe the algorithm's behavior under various conditions. First, there's normal data. This is the kind of input the program is generally expected to handle for a race example, maybe a mix of realistic finish times like 10.5 seconds, 11.2, 9.9, etc.
Look, the expected stuff.
Then, importantly, there's extreme data. This consists of values right at the boundaries of the valid range. What if the fastest time is exactly zero? Is that possible? What if it's the largest possible number the system can handle? Or what if every single runner finishes at precisely the same time? How does the algorithm handle ties?
The edge cases.
Exactly, the edge cases. And maybe even more critical is exceptional data. This covers invalid inputs, things that lie beyond the extremes, or are just the completely wrong type. Like, what happens if someone accidentally types DNS for did not start instead of a number for a runner's time? Or maybe just random text. Does the program crash or does it handle the error gracefully?
Right, so you're not just checking if it works when things go right, but also if it can handle the unexpected, or at least fail predictably without causing chaos. So if testing does reveal a problem, if something goes wrong, how do programmers actually find the source of that error in the algorithm's logic? What's the debugging process like?
That's where debugging comes in, and thankfully there are several clever techniques programmers use. One common method, especially for simpler logic, is a dry run. You literally manually step through the code line by line on paper, acting as the computer yourself, keeping track of how the values in your variables change at each step.
Like playing computer?
Pretty much, yeah. A more formal version of this is creating a trace table. This is a meticulously organized table, again, usually on paper or maybe a spreadsheet, that records the value of each important variable after each line of code executes. It's incredibly helpful for untangling complex logic flows.
Okay, sounds methodical.
It is. And for bigger problems or within modern programming environments, developers rely heavily on breakpoints. A breakpoint allows them to tell the development tool, pause the program's execution right here at this specific line of code.
So it just stops.
It just freezes right there. And when it's paused, the programmer can then inspect the contents of variables and arrays at that exact moment in time. They can see exactly what value current minimum holds, what the next array element is, and so on.
That sounds incredibly useful.
Oh, it's essential. For our find minimum algorithm, these tools, dry runs, trace tables, breakpoints, are absolutely critical to verifying that the smallest value is being correctly identified at each step of the loop. You can check, is the current minimum variable being updated precisely when it should be? Is it being skipped when it shouldn't be? Are there any unexpected behaviors cropping up, especially with that extreme or exceptional data we talked about? Debugging helps pinpoint exactly where the logic went astray.
So there you have it. The find minimum algorithm. It seems like such a simple idea on the surface, just finding the smallest number in a list. But it actually underpins so much of what computers do. It really is a perfect example of a foundational computational pattern that, once you kind of understand it, unlocks a deeper appreciation for the software that's all around us.
Indeed. And understanding these standard algorithms like find minimum is far from just an academic exercise, you know. It genuinely allows for the creation of more robust, more maintainable, and crucially more efficient software. This core concept, this iterative comparison and updating a stored value, it's a fundamental building block for a vast array of complex data analysis and optimization problems that touch almost every industry imaginable.
So for you, our curious listener, hopefully this deep dive into fine minimum might just change how you look at every sorted list or every data summary you encounter from now on. Maybe you'll start seeing the elegant, logical process humming away beneath the surface, even in the simplest of tasks.
And as you think about the power of this simple logic, maybe consider this. Beyond just numbers, how might the core idea of fine minimum be adapted? How could you use it to find the minimum of other types of data, perhaps finding the shortest word in a long text document, or the earliest date in a historical sequence, or maybe even the least frequent item in some sprawling database? The possibilities are truly endless once you grasp that underlying computational pattern.